Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back. This is a supplemental show. Last week, I had the pleasure of being interviewed for the Sample Hour by host Drew Sample, and I really enjoyed this conversation. I thought I would repost it. There is some stuff, some stories that some of you might have heard before. So this is an experiment. For the first time ever, I have put chapters into the show. So if you feel like, hey, I've heard this before, you just press the forward button on whatever your device is and it will skip to the next subject in the conversation. So I'll just give you some time codes here if you want to jump around. If you're really pressed for time and you just want to hear one thing, or you can just hit the forward button a bunch of times and the show is over. You know, that's an easy way to listen. But anyway, the conversation starts and it's a lot of me talking about my stories as either a student or as an educator. At about the 45-20 portion of the conversation, we talk about starting the podcast. At 54-30, we talk about turning the show in a more positive direction. At 58-30, we talk about positivity versus negativity in our media consumption. At the 61-minute mark, procrastination and productivity. At the 68-minute and 15-second mark, we talk about monetizing a media project. And then at the 94-minute and 50-second mark, we have something called new subscriber geography trivia. So thanks, everybody, for listening. The next show will probably be the next installment in the Logic Saves Live series. I'm also planning on sitting down with Carlos Morales soon to talk about his new book on child protective services. And of course, I'm always looking for your input. Who would you like to hear in the Freedom of Success series? What would you like to hear covered in the Logic Saves Lives series? And please also check our YouTube channel. I'm spending a lot of time working on the Underground History of American Education video series, pulling excerpts from John Taylor Gatto's book of the same title and turning them into what I'm told are very enjoyable videos. So if you are not familiar with our YouTube channel, it's username School Sucks Podcast. Please join our group, School Sucks Project on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, School Sucks Show, and shop with us. Here's a new thing. Shop with us on Amazon. There's a link to enter Amazon right on the front page of School Sucks. That is a fairly passive way for people to help the show. I really look forward to seeing how that turns out, because there's a lot of you and you shop. I know you do. I see you with your things. All right, thanks, everyone. Have a great day. Here is my discussion with Drew Sample on The Sample Hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of The Sample Hour. Today, I was actually joined by host of the School Sucks podcast, whose name I repeatedly say incorrectly throughout the podcast. I keep saying vignette, but it's actually Vinat. So, Brett, my apologies. Thank you for not correcting me or being upset. Secondly, before we get into the show, we'd just like to let you all know, if you're in Ohio, we are having another Death Squad Ohio party, pre- and post-show party. So Brian Redband, Tiffany Haddish, and Dion Del Rey are coming in. It's going to be the Death Squad Draft Open Mic Battle podcast. Live at the Columbus Funny Bone at Easton. So that is Thursday the 16th. The first show starts at 7. We're going to be going to both shows. At 5:30, we're going to be at the World of Beer at Easton. Should be a pretty good time. And then after the show, we'll be going there as well. Please go to iTunes and rate and subscribe and comment. Give me a review for the Sample Hour. Also give School Sucks Podcast a review. Please go to Brett's website, schoolsucksproject.com, and contribute. Brett does this full time. He puts out a lot of great content. I'm a fan of his myself. So please contribute. If you wouldn't, also go to inspireddisordercollective.com, go to the Sample Hour's page, and there, if you can see some of Ray Taylor's art as well, there's a link with a coupon on there. So you can help contribute to the Sample Hour via that, and also help out Ray Taylor, who's got some awesome art. And check out all the other great podcasts on the Inspired Disorder Collective. Anyways, guys, I really appreciate you tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Sample Hour. I'm very happy to have this guest on. You may know him. Well, you should know him from the host of the School Sucks podcast. I've been a big fan of this gentleman's show, especially the series he did with Gino Denning and multiple others. You've had so many good shows, but Mr. Brett Vignette, how are you doing today, sir?
Good, Drew. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. So the reason why I wanted to have you on, I really want to kind of talk to you about you. Like, I think you have an interesting story, and I'd like to have you kind of dig into that and kind of get into the podcast and how you started the podcast. So so if you don't mind, so you're originally a school teacher. So what kind of got you on the path of saying, I'm done with this and I'm going to start doing something else?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would even say more importantly than once I was a school teacher, once I was a school pupil, and that sucked. It was terrible. Pretty much the entire experience, I was in school for a total of, including kindergarten, 19 years. So I remember graduating from high school and thinking I was pretty dumb. And I really didn't enjoy any intellectual pursuits. All I was really into in college when I went there when I was 18 was partying. That was the reason why I went. I didn't even want to go to college. I wanted to go on tour with the Grateful Dead. So I wound up at a pretty mediocre school in southern Vermont, and I almost failed. I don't know if I was failing, but my grades, I was definitely on what they called academic probation after my first year. So I was a pretty frustrated student, and I really didn't take it seriously because I really just couldn't take it seriously. It was too much a negative experience that I think I learned by the time I was like a junior or a senior in high school that if I took this seriously, it would be really demoralizing. So I just saw school as a chore. And I didn't like to read. I pretty much picked my major based on an interest that I had when I was like 12. Like, I remember I wanted to be a sportscaster. Like, I loved baseball so much growing up. That was the only passion that I had from a very young age right through high school. Whether it was playing baseball or the Boston Red Sox, I loved baseball. And I thought that since I was probably never going to be a pro athlete, I learned that in school, that I would think about being in the broadcast booth. And my parents found this sportscaster camp that all the Boston television sports celebrities would come and speak at. So I went there like 3 years in a row from the time I was like maybe 12 to 14 and hadn't really given any thought to what I wanted to do with my life. So when I was like 17 or 18, I said, oh yeah, communications, that will be my major. And that's what I took with me to college when I was a freshman in 1995. The whole communications industry was revolutionized by digital while I was in school, learning how to do everything basically analog. And when I graduated in 2000, I really didn't have the skills to do too much. So while I was in college, I wound up having this experience with a professor, a history professor, who really ignited this interest in the subject of history, world history, U.S. history, the Civil War. I remember being really, really interested in the Civil War for a while. And I remember sitting in his class and kind of watching him, admiring him, and being like, I might like to do this. This maybe is the path for me. So when I graduated from college, I actually had gotten a job at a residential school in the town where I went to college in Bennington, Vermont. And I just started as basically a grunt worker. My title was a residential counselor. And I, you know, started to see that in this place, there was opportunities to move up. So I started looking for ways to do that. And eventually I wound up in their education department. And I'll pause there if you have any questions. But that was pretty much the story of me from about 6 to 21.
So it was like, you think like school just pretty much beat you down to the, like, were you diagnosed with having any disabilities or anything like that?
No, I just missed that. Like, I remember when I was maybe a sophomore in high school hearing about a friend of mine who, no, I was a junior in high school. And I remember hearing about a friend of mine who had been diagnosed with ADD and he was taking Ritalin. And then I had another friend when I was a junior and a senior, not a good influence, but he had kind of hacked the system to, I don't know if he had a copy of the DSM-3, it might have been at the time, maybe it was the DSM-4, but he had figured out how to get prescriptions for a lot of these drugs. They didn't have Adderall then, but they had, not that I know of anyway, but they had Ritalin. And he got a prescription for Ritalin, so we would ditch school and take Ritalin. So it was like, on some days, my senior year, that I had been diagnosed with ADD because I had Ritalin in my pocket and in my system. But no, I think I just missed that, the heavy period of diagnosis. I mean, I think I probably could have been diagnosed with ADHD. I think I probably could have been labeled dyslexic because of the way that I learned to read. And I remember struggling with reading. I was a late reader. I don't think I really felt proficient with reading and writing until I was 6 or 7. And, you know, I think if somebody had watched me read, watched me try to sound words out, they could have stuck a dyslexia label on me as well. But no, I escaped all that. And, you know, never took any drugs except for the ones that I wrongfully obtained while ditching school.
Yeah, I was the opposite, man. I was diagnosed with ADD and oppositional defiance disorder.
Yeah.
And I started taking Ritalin when I was like in eighth grade, and I started doing better in school. But then I don't know, I'm like, my creativity wasn't really the same, and I didn't ditch that stuff till I was like 22.
Now, can I ask how you got labeled oppositional defiant?
So... a lot of times with that diagnosis too, which is interesting, is like a lot of people think it's from bad parenting. And a lot of times, but no, like from a young age, like if somebody said something stupid to me, like I never thought like because I said so was a good answer. Like I really wanted to know why. And so I just throw temper tantrums and I'm like, well, you're going to give me that answer. That's how I'm gonna, or if I couldn't get my way. Like I've always like, and then like, that's how I was diagnosed. Like I'd always fight. Like I'd always stand up for myself and fight. And then, that was interesting because then I think I got to a point too when I stopped doing that. And then, that's kind of a weird thing to think about when I go back in time and like think, like, cause like, I think when my parents kind of split up and we moved to Columbus, I stopped standing up for myself. And then when I moved back to Toledo, I kind of remembered who I was before. Weird thing. And like, I don't know. Like I think about that stuff a lot, like my relationship with my parents and how that affected me in a different way. But,
that's so true. You know, I just want to say like, I gave you like a couple of bullet points about school. And I said, that's the story of me from age 6 to 21. Well, it's, you know, it's a small piece of the story of me. Obviously, because those dynamics play into it, you know, who we are in such a huge way. And, you know, that's something that I've tried to stress on my show where appropriate. Obviously, there's people who are doing a more thorough job than me, like Wes Bertrand and Stefan Molyneux. And I, you know, usually refer people to their work. But, you know, as far as the oppositional defiant thing goes, and you talk about, you know, not taking because I told you so for an answer or standing up or acting out. You know, the milieu hurts us either way, right? Because for me, it was just, I was a total retreater. You know, I just kind of resigned myself to like, oh, well, I guess this is, you know, life sucks and it's hard and you don't get your way and you can't assert yourself. So, I mean, I just got very small, I think, in a lot of ways. And obviously where I felt where it was safe to rebel, you know, like I would ditch school. I would get very good at like forging signatures. So I would ditch school and do drugs. But, you know, that was a kind of passive rebellion for sure. I wasn't standing up to anybody to their face. I was just too beaten down to do that.
It's interesting, man. I mean, you've referenced it a lot, John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of the American Education. I think,
like
when he starts talking about like how the way like teachers and everybody else handles students, like my friend Gina Tron, she's actually from Vermont. She was a suspected high school shooter, and the whole school, like pretty much administrators on down, alienated her, and like teachers didn't want her in the class. And it was all because they thought she might become a high school shooter. Like, it was just like a gross negligence.
Wow.
Oh yeah. Like it's crazy. And that's to me, like, that's like a classic example of like school. Like,
so you're talking about like pre-crime, right? You're like, when you said, I thought the way you said it, I thought they were investigating a shooting that had taken place. We're talking like Minority Report stuff here, right?
Talking some Philip K. Dick short stories here. Like, she had this cartoon book that she'd drawn, and it was like a big joke. And they just singled her out. I mean, they just like, she dressed weird, and like, she's a really good writer. Like, she's wrote some articles in Vice and she's talked about it. Like, you know, she pretty much kind of fed into it because it gave her a certain amount of power.
Yeah.
When you're an outsider kid and everybody in you, and like you were saying, when you feel small, if you have an opportunity to kind of like say, oh yeah, I can push on your splinters, or I can emotional splinters or whatever. Like, I can fuck with you back, then I'm going to.
Yeah.
And I think it's like the, it's interesting, man. It's like, it's the psychology of it. Like, it's Pete, like, I don't know. It's so much stuff. Like, teachers don't, like, they don't give a shit because they probably got in and thought they could do one thing, and then they realized that they couldn't. And then like, there they are. And it's like, okay, well, I need to pay my bills, so I'm going to keep showing up to work.
Yeah. It's a diverse group. I mean, you know, I don't like to say teachers are, or teachers feel, or teachers do. You know, I think there are some people who are very idealistic. I remember when I started teaching, I really thought that this was the path to changing the world. And maybe I sounded like, you know, an early 20th century progressive with some of the things that I would have been saying. You know, people like John Dewey might have been very proud of me my first year of teaching. But that faded fast. And I wasn't even in the public system. I was in private school. But others, I think they see it as a profession. They see it as a relatively easy profession to get into. I remember, you know, showing my mom one of my videos, because my mom was a teacher in Pennsylvania in the inner city until I was born. And, you know, I was talking in the video about how teachers have good intentions, you know, kind of making this broad generalization. And she's like, I didn't get into it for any kind of good intentions or any kind of idealism. You know, I graduated from high school in 1967, maybe. And they said, you can be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher because you're a woman. And that's kind of our inheritance. You know, how old are you?
I'm 29.
Okay, so I'm 37. So we're close enough to that, you know, that's the kind of personnel that we inherited the system from, you know, like people who, probably mostly women, who in many cases, even if they were like kind of okay with being there in the beginning, probably a lot of the time wound up being there against their will, you know, because what else were they going to do in the 60s and in the 70s or before that? So that's part of it too. So, I mean, obviously teachers are a very diverse group, but I try to be sympathetic to their struggle, because the system beats everybody down. You know, the system can make victims out of everybody.
Yeah, no, it's the state. Yeah, it's absolutely right. Like, mm-hmm. You go back to it, you can point fingers at everything, but when you think about it, it's like, yeah, it's really just kind of the system and that's set up. So getting back on pace to the story of Brett Vignette.
Sure.
So when you're working this job, is it like something like you're kind of like working at the registrar's office kind of at the school, or like your technical, cause your technical title, like it was a student.
Residential counselor. And what I did is, this is how I wound up getting the job. I was like a senior in college, and I had been working in a convenience store for one job and a video store for another job. And this was like 1999. So I was probably making about $6 an hour at each job. And a friend of mine who worked with me part-time at the convenience store, we were talking one night. That was a great job, by the way, working in a convenience store for a college kid. You know, we were just sitting there and we could smoke cigarettes. That was pretty much what we did, and chat.
Like Clerks?
I remember when I saw Clerks, it was so similar to that. We weren't as witty, but no one was writing dialogue for us. So
thing too is you worked at a video store as well. So you managed to have both Daryl and Dante's jobs.
And I had probably seen Clerks by then. So yeah, I did. I worked at a convenience store and a video store. They weren't right next to each other. They were down the street from each other. So my friend says to me, you know, I got this job at this school where I make $8.50 an hour. And that seemed, at the time, that was a lot of money. I mean, that was like getting $300-something a week every week. And I said, yeah, I'll go check it out, because it was interesting. There was kind of like this confluence of life events, that one being just very simple and seemingly inconsequential, just somebody telling me where I can get a better paying job. But I had left college in 1999 for a semester to do an internship with a filmmaker who was partners with my uncle. My uncle had been a film producer and a Broadway producer, and he had done Mississippi Burning was one of his movies, The Paper, Quiz Show, and then he kind of just went on and did theater work. So the two of them worked together, and they are based in Woburn, Massachusetts. So I came home from Vermont and just worked as basically a script reader, and, you know, deciding whether something should be sent to New York to get looked at by an actual professional or brought to a dumpster, because we had this tiny little office and it was just filled with scripts that people sent in.
That's a cool job, man. Like, how did they learn to just trust your taste in scripts?
Well, see, that's the other thing too. I think it was kind of like a make work job, because it was kind of family. You know, this guy, his name was Nick Palaiologos, and he had a pretty lengthy career in Massachusetts state government. He had been like best friends with my uncle, my mother's brother, since, you know, they were kids growing up outside of Boston. So I think, you know, my mom just said, you know, Brett's really interested in film. Can you get him in to work with you? And I think it was kind of like, yeah, we can find something for him to do. So they probably had this, it was a windowless room about the size of a college dorm room. It had a metal desk and a rotary telephone in it. And then it was just file cabinets and scripts. So I think it was stuff that all probably would have wound up in a dumpster anyway, but they thought I could maybe try to mine for gold, you know, using whatever writing or, you know, script gold identification skills I had at the time. So they let me, I would go down there a few times a week and sit in this office, with no windows and a rotary phone, and, just read scripts. And sometimes I would, if I got bored, I would storyboard them a little bit. So I would draw, and sometimes I would get up and I would start going through file cabinets, because one of my projects was to sort through all Nick's stuff and organize things based on theme or subject matter. And he had all these newspaper clippings, and he was very liberal, and he had been involved in the education, public education in Massachusetts. And I said, wow, look at all the things that this guy's done. And he's, you know, he's made these movies that had a social message, and he's politically active. And I said, you know, this, I guess, is how you make a meaningful life. You know, you get involved, you try to help people. And that's, you know, a kind of way, like, what can you do for society determines your value. These are kind of the lessons that I'm getting from a liberal politician and a very liberal higher education experience. So when I left there, I said, okay, well, I have to do something that has a kind of social worth, even if it involves a sacrifice. And the experience that I started having at this school when I started working there, like, end of 99, beginning of 2000 was exactly that. It sucked, right? But these poor children, you know, they need someone who's had all the advantages that I've had.
That's such a common thing. And it's really like a, that's such a funny perspective because like I grew up, you know, from my mom's very liberal and I noticed that with a lot of liberals, like they have this, like they deserve our help. And it's like, man, like you want to help people just because you feel like you should, because you've had it better. I don't necessarily think that's a good reason to help people.
Yeah, they kind of slalom back and forth between outrage and pity, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like helping somebody out of pity. That's the word I was looking for. Isn't always a way to do it. But anyways, continue. Sorry about that.
It was that set of experiences that brought me to the school and I think kept me at the school because the work was absolutely exhausting. And at times, because it was kind of traumatic, like you would see some pretty gruesome things. And it was very hands-on. When I started, the school did physical restraints. I eventually learned my way out of doing that. But yeah, you really took it home with you. I started dating a girl who was a teacher there shortly after I started working there. And we would leave work and we would just talk about work until we went to bed. So I'm really trying to give an honest answer as to why I stayed. I wound up getting burned out after being there. I mean, I started there in, let's say, January 2000. I graduated from college in May, and then I worked there for about another year before I quit and said I should try to get a job using my degree. So I wound up getting a job in marketing at a ski resort. But after I got laid off from that, I went back to the school and I asked to work during the school day. When I started, I was like a residential worker, which was like, you know, helping kids with rec and supervising meals and taking kids to do their laundry and supervising bedtime and wake ups. And it was a job that anybody could do. And when I went back to the school, I wanted to kind of have this forward progress because I had, you know, in the year and a half that I was there, I had gotten additional responsibilities. I got to be like an adventure person. So I'd get to take kids on trips. I got a pay raise. So I wanted to keep that forward momentum. I knew enough to know that like careers are supposed to move forward and you're supposed to move up within an organization. So I kind of moved sideways into the education, place because from the time that I left to the time that I came back, in the period that I was gone working at the ski resort, 9/11 happened. And for some reason that kind of, the whole experience of like watching the news and getting so immersed in all these things that I had never really paid attention to, even though I had become pretty passionate about history in college, this had kind of reinvigorated the interest in history and geopolitics. And I said, okay, in this world, I need to pay attention. And I really think, you know, I should be working in education. I mean, I really feel like those were the decisions that I made that started to lead me to where I was today. So I went back and I was just a teacher's aide, and I wound up getting there was this campus for younger kids, and they had somebody working there called a behavior manager. And the guy who did the job, I think he had a heart attack and he had to leave, and so I wound up being taken from being in the school building to sent to this other school campus. And I basically just sat in a hallway with kids who misbehaved and occasionally had to like physically restrain them. And that was probably the worst experience that I ever had there, because these kids just struggled so much, you know, with so many personal and emotional issues. A lot of them had no parents. They were heavily drugged. They just weren't set up to handle a typical school day, but that's what was being asked of them. And, you know, I was just the bad guy, the scary guy. That was my job, to be an enforcer. So I said, okay, well, I got to move somewhere from this. And, they had another campus for the school, so all the same school. They had another campus for kids who had been sexually abused, and they separated these kids from everybody else because of the, you know, the liability factor that they would, you know, try to get together with other boys. It was all boys. And I asked them to make me the lead teacher of that whole campus. It was a job that nobody wanted, but it was something that I could have ownership over. So in 2002, they moved me there. And that was where I would say my professional career actually began. So I worked there for 2 years. I would say it was as big of a success as it could be, considering a lot of the obstacles. And then when I had proven myself, I asked them to move me to another school that they ran when a history teaching position opened up. And then I did that. And I taught history in private school and high school math. And I did that until 2006. And that was when I left classroom teaching for good.
So what was it that, and that is quite like a crazy, man, like I wouldn't want to do most of those jobs that you said, just because it's like, that's like really emotionally draining.
It was. I mean, I can just like, I've told these stories on the show before. And so let me just get an example of something that one thing that happened one day to help color this in for people who, you know, have heard me tell these stories before. So I'm teaching one day, and I've got about 10 kids in a classroom, and we have this self-contained building, and I have two aides and one behavior manager working with me, and then I'm kind of running a bunch of other people in and out of the building to do art or Title I, which was like some government program. I was like a reading program. I don't remember all the details. So people were always coming and going, but I had about 10 kids and three or four staff that I was responsible for on a regular basis. So one kid starts acting up, and he runs out of the classroom, and this female teacher's aide that I have goes after him. She wasn't very good at conflict resolution. She wasn't very good at diffusing situations. And of course, everybody was very frustrated. Everybody was burned out. Everyone was high strung who did this job. So patience was really at a premium. You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, here's another situation that we have to deal with. You know, let's take a deep breath. It was just one thing after another. It was really like, we use the phrase whack-a-mole a lot. You know, are you familiar with that?
Like the game Whack-A-Mole, the moles that come out and you...
Yeah, and you hit a mole and another one pops up. It's not the best way to think about working with kids, but that was actually an expression that we used. And so this teacher's aide that I have is dealing with a student, and I can tell that it's escalating. And I feel like, I'm in a classroom with kids that I can't turn my back on, because that was one of the rules, that these kids could not be unsupervised even for a second. Because of their sexual issues, they would do things like, if a staff turned their back, a kid could stand up and just pull his pants down, you know?
Wow.
And that would activate this kind of sexual response or the sexual reactivity in the other kids. So these were the things the people who ran the school were afraid of. And in fact, the kids had been so programmed, and I've told this story before too, that if a staff walked out of the room even for a second, the kids would all start screaming unsafe, unsafe, like robots, until the staff walked back in. And then they would just stop and go back to whatever they were doing. So it was very strange. There was a lot of unsettling aspects to it. So I hear the situation escalating outside the room. I'm waiting for this other teacher's aide to come back in so I can go and start getting involved with this problem. So all of a sudden I hear screaming. The female teacher's aide is screaming. So at this point I have to do something, because she's like screaming in pain. So this boy, maybe 15 or 16, kind of a wiry, strong type, I go outside and he's got her by the hair. He's holding her hair and kicking her in the face.
Oh my God.
So suddenly, now there's a bunch of staff available, and we had to turn our back on 10 kids. And I don't know, I still don't know what they could have done to each other while we weren't watching. Maybe nothing, because there's this pretty startling event going on outside, right outside the classroom. So suddenly it's me, the other teacher's aide appears, the behavior manager appears, and we're trying to separate these two people as this boy is ripping this girl's hair and trying to kick her. So I remember at first he goes down to the ground. He still won't let go of her hair. You can see her hair just being like ripped out of her head. And he's now just trying to kick her in the shins and kick her wherever he can. So he's just gone completely uncontrollable. And that was, I remember this event so clearly, because it was the last physical restraint that I ever did. And it had been a long time since I had done one before that. But I remember just putting this kid down on the ground and being on top of him and having him like you know, we kind of would take their arms and use their arms like a straitjacket. And I just remember like being so angry and just squeezing this kid. I was holding him by the wrists and just squeezing his wrists so hard because I was so angry. I didn't know what to do. And I was so basically traumatized by what I had seen. And so the female teacher's aide ran out of the building, crying, and obviously took the rest of the day off. But that was one of the most insane situations that I ever remember trying to defuse. And there were kids who would fight staff. I remember having to run outside because this kid tried to run away, and he was a big, kind of a strong kid. And he was just in a fist fight with another one of my staff. And, you know, I remember like the guy from the kitchen was delivering lunch, and he's like walking into the building with lunch. And I'm like, you have to stay and watch the kids. You have to stay and watch the kids. I have to run down the street and get involved in this fight. So it wasn't always that intense, but moments that intense, they stay with you. They go home with you.
Like, I had no idea you had to deal with all that craziness, man. That sucks.
Well, that was what cured me. Yeah. Of my liberalism, you know, and my kind of progressive idealism that, oh, okay, here's the treatment of children in state custody. And, you know, I realized that it wasn't really any different anywhere else. And it was also around the time, like around 2002, I started going to graduate school to get a master's. And by like 2003, 2004, that's when I started like understanding the school picture a little better. Certainly not completely, but I was like moving away from, you know, let's get John Kerry elected and into like, wow, there's a whole bunch of shit here that's going on that nobody is talking about. And, you know, my whole mindset started to change, usually just during like research accidents in you know, the master's program that I was in. I mentioned in the last show that I did that it was then, I can't remember exactly when in that process it was, that I stumbled across Gatto's work. And I was like, school is a conspiracy. Come on, you know, conspiracy to dumb people down. But then I remember seeing that and saying, oh, well, that's silly. But then I was like, oh, well, but that's like a perfect plan.
Yeah.
You know, that makes so much sense. If you're going to tell people that they're free, yeah, you'd probably want to control how they think at least a little bit. So, I mean, that brings us to like, you know, 2006, the other school that I worked at was not hands-on at all. There was, you know, it was difficult some days, but it was, I got to teach history. I worked about 28 hours a week, and that was full time. So it was, you know, public school schedule. And,
it was pretty cushy, but at the same time, it just wasn't what you wanted to do.
Well, it wasn't. I miss that. I miss that job. I miss being in a room full of people, the eye contact, you know, yeah. and telling these stories, you know, and kind of I thought that I had the ability. And I think in the beginning, I was kind of copying the history professor, like his style. But I think I kind of eventually made it my own way of breathing life into what I had always thought were these horribly boring stories of American history. And I remember winning some of the kids over, and I remember that feeling really, really great. You know, like I would go home from that job not thinking about, oh my God, what a nightmare. And now I have to, you know, fill my head with all of these dark thoughts and visions of everything that happened today. Like I would go home feeling pretty good. Like, yeah, I did a lecture today and that was fun. And kids asked questions and people, you know, were involved. And, you know, a lot of kids would sleep in the class, but there wasn't much I could do about that. I didn't realize at the time there was, you know, I remember this one kid who it was just so frustrating to me. He would come in the class and he would fall asleep. Well, I didn't know at the time that he was on all kinds of prescription medication. And that's what he did during the day. He slept because he couldn't stay awake. So I just kind of took it as an insult. So I liked that, but that's kind of what I get to do now. You know, I can't see people face to face, but I'm still doing all the things that I love about that job. In a way, I still do that now with School Sucks. So I'm pretty happy about that.
So you like you get to the point and you're like, I don't want to work. I don't want to be a teacher anymore. Like, what was your plan to just quit that job? Like, what were you going to do? So when you decided to walk away, take off the golden handcuffs, what was kind of like, I mean, obviously your past history, but you actually had a pretty good job. It wasn't bad. So what was it that was just like, you know, I'm done with this.
All right. Pretty simple. I had a girlfriend at the time, and it's funny. All of the, like, the behind the scenes motivators of our life story, you know? So it was 2006 and I had been at this job, a beautiful resort town of Manchester Center, Vermont. And we had a nice apartment. She had a good job. I worked at the school. And in 2006, we decided that we were going to move to Salem, Massachusetts. Her best friend lived there, and my family lived about 45 minutes away in New Hampshire. And I'd been away from most of them for like almost 10 years at this point. So I thought, yeah, well, that would be nice to be close to my family again. And, you know, she would be near her best friend, and we would be in Boston, like basically in the Boston, the metro area, where there would be a lot of opportunities. She worked in sales. And I didn't know what I was going to do. So, you know, we moved there, and we both had money at the time. So we moved into a condo on the waterfront in Salem, and we bought a new car. And then we were like, all right, well, we better find some jobs. So she found a sales job almost immediately. Like, she was a young, personable, energetic, attractive girl who had, you know, a sales history. So she went right to work. And I was painting houses when we moved. Then I was interviewing for tutoring jobs. I would just get on the train, you know, go to Boston, have an interview, and like go to these learning centers. And then I just found this small company like south of Boston near Dedham, where there's like a giant Horace Mann statue, I realized one day when I was driving down there. And she's like, yeah, your resume looks great. I'll pay you $35 an hour to come tutor, to do academic tutoring and the SAT tutoring. And she's like, does that work for you? And $35 an hour was like about twice what I had made anywhere, you know? So I jumped on that job right away, and I would do anything for work. You know, I would drive to, I know this doesn't make sense to most people, but I would drive to Framingham. I would drive to New Hampshire. I would drive to Maine. I would drive to, you know, 45 minutes south of Boston from Salem. And driving in that state, Massachusetts, it's the worst state to drive in.
Yeah.
You know, the traffic is horrible. The people in the cars are very inconsiderate. They're very nice out of their cars, but I don't know, something happens to them in their cars.
There's too many people, man. That's pretty much it.
Well, I mean, they're probably all frustrated, right? The Massachusetts highways, it's like the public schools of transportation, right? So it's probably the same things that a lot of those public school teachers are dealing with. So anyway, yeah, I would do anything to go someplace and work for 2 hours and have that be worth $70. And suddenly I found a way to do that, like 30 hours a week. And then I got another job as a copywriter for a car website in Cambridge near Harvard. So, and they let me work from home, and they paid like $20 an hour. So all of a sudden I was like, you know, I was working 50 hours a week. I was making what seemed like a ton of money. And I didn't ask too many questions about what they wanted me to do, but I was doing this academic tutoring, which was like, you know, you're getting bad grades and here I am. And I realized I was just kind of being an enforcer for the school, and that started to get old after not too long. So I continued doing the SAT tutoring. I would still do the SAT tutoring because I think it has some value, but I really just, as time went on, I just enjoyed that work less and less. And I stopped doing it around 2008 and started my own company that just did, or started a company with somebody else that just exclusively did SAT. So I wouldn't have to do the, you know, you need better grades, house calls anymore.
Yeah.
And, that's what I did that until I just quit to work on the podcast full time. I did a brief stint with a company called Catalyst. They had this thing called the SAT Bootcamp. I did that when I was in Connecticut, last year. And that, and then any business, like the last time I did an SAT class was probably 7 or 8 months ago, it feels like. And it's just kind of like residual word of mouth from, you know, an area that I was working a lot in like 3 years ago. Somebody said, oh, you know, so-and-so's kid had you in 2011. Do you still do this? And I say, yes, I'll still do it. And I'll go out there and do it. Even though I don't do it. But that's, it's been, I think those residuals have kind of worn out at this point. You know, there's always competition popping up in tutoring. So I haven't done that work in a long time.
So what made you want to start the podcast? So you're doing that. You're just kind of doing odd jobs. And then you're like, you know what? I want to, like, what inspired you to say, I want to be a podcaster?
Okay. So it was probably a series of things. When I was tutoring, and I was traveling in Boston, I was commuting a lot. I was on the train a lot, and I had an iPod. So I remember like probably my podcast playlist being like real 9/11-y at the time, you know, like that was kind of my thing. That was what I was into. And for some reason I stumbled across Free Talk Live in 2006. I started listening to that, and I thought these were just like the most fascinating conversations. I really loved the ones with Mark, Ian, and Gardner Goldsmith, who used to be on the show every Monday night. Or Wednesday, whatever it was, he was on one night, and it was the three of them. And the conversations just seemed so energetic and so new. And it was so interesting to hear people talk about current events in this way that I'd never heard current events talked about before. And I found myself, you know, listening to them and pausing and kind of talking to myself and thinking about, you know, the things they were saying and coming to embrace libertarianism. And now, you know, adding, okay, what else is like Free Talk Live? And I remember I found Wes Bertrand and Complete Liberty. And, you know, he at the time had only done like 12 or 13 shows, but he had his audiobook, Complete Liberty. It was a pretty transformative book. I should remember the subtitle. Have you read Complete Liberty?
I haven't, man. I am, like, what's funny is like my path to like the liberty movement, it's very different than a lot of people's. Like, I don't know a lot of the people that like a lot of the like current minds of it. Like, I've never really checked out Wes Bertrand. Like, I know Chris Stefanik said, you know, he's a big fan, and I've heard you talk about him, but I just haven't checked him out. Like, I probably will eventually. It's just a matter of time.
If you've heard my show, I'm sure you've heard him on my show in the past. But I found his book, and he just put it all out there so clearly. And I said, yes, I'm a libertarian. And the other good news is now, like, all of this, like this collage, like all of these scraps that I've been collecting, this educational research, like what's wrong with the school system, now it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Now there's kind of something at the middle of it, like, oh, this whole system is made possible by the use of force, by the violation of property rights, by the disrespecting of individual volition. That's what makes it possible. Maybe that's what the problem is. Maybe we're not looking at a reform project here. Maybe this system needs to go. So it was shortly after that, listening to Wes, I started to get into Free Domain Radio and, you know, Steph's work. And so I had done so much talking to myself. And the other thing that I liked to do was find people with whom I disagreed. So I would get like NPR podcasts and Real Time with Bill Maher. Audio somehow. I don't remember how I got it, but I remember just pausing these people that I disagreed with and arguing with them in my head and coming up with all these witty zingers and one-liners. And I was like, wow, I'm pretty clever, you know? And I was painting a house in the summer of 2009. Painting was like a summer thing for me, you know, like, cause I had been a teacher from 2004 to 2006, and tutoring always slowed down in the summer. So I painted and did, like, you know, light carpentry and restoration work in the summers. And it was the summer of 2009, and I'm just working at this house. The people were on vacation. There was no crew. I was just there by myself. I'm listening to Free Talk Live, maybe some Free Domain Radio, complete liberty, and I'm just having a field day talking to myself. And I say, all right, well, I know how to record. I had conceived the whole school sucks thing, not the whole thing, everything it is now, but like a whole school sucks story as kind of a documentary treatment already that didn't go anywhere. That was like the first form that I really thought it should take, is that it should be like a documentary film. I said, okay, well, I have all these ideas. I've talked this out before. I left part of the story out. In the end of 2008, I wrote to Wes, and it was like winter 2008, like maybe December 2008. And I said, can I audition to be on Complete Liberty to talk about education? And I maybe wrote some of my experience down, and I said, you know, oh, it'd be a great thing for, you know, I'll try out or whatever I need to do. And he's like, yeah, I think you can just come on the show, you know, if you're qualified. So we actually started talking and started becoming friends, and we did some shows together. And then we just kind of went our separate ways. Spring 2009. And I started to like get really antsy, you know, like I need to get more stuff out. And so I contacted Wes at some point in the summer of 2009, and we did some more shows with this other guy, Daniel Lockemacher, who used the non-aggression principle to get out of the Navy as a conscientious objector, which is a pretty cool story. And I forget what we were doing some kind of series at the time. But I was like, okay, I need my own platform. I've got this idea. It's ready to go. I have so much stuff to say. And in August, you know, with no technical skills, with no good equipment, I just said, I'm going to start putting my voice into MP3 files and putting them on the internet. And that's what I did.
That's pretty awesome, man. Yeah, it's similar for me. What I noticed is after I started my podcast, I stopped wearing out my friends and family with my views of the world. Like, it was like I had like an outlet, like similar, like I felt like, yeah, man, yeah. I had like this world view that I needed to share. And it sounds like it was similar for you, except it was a lot antsier for you. So you got a podcast.
See, the difference is, though, it emboldened me. Right. Like at first, like, cause I was really frustrated too with all of these debates. And, I remember I talked a lot with my father, and he would tell you, like, he would tell anybody, he's like, I'm just very naive. I just think, you know, we get back to the Constitution and, you know,
yeah.
he's that kind of a guy. So he doesn't want to try and wrap his head around a lot of this. He'll sit there and listen when I do have an opportunity to talk to him, but he kind of just retreats to wherever he was before that. So, but then I had more contentious interactions with other people who are on the other side of the political spectrum, the left, and I had a lot of pent up frustration. But when I started the podcast, and I was like, oh, well, now people listen to what I have to say. People are donating money, you know? So that there was a time when it emboldened me at first. And then after I had done the podcast for about a year, I remember having this one particularly negative and kind of hostile interaction. And I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe I need to be more empathetic, because like there's lots of mistakes that I've made. I think something I was going through kind of a personal crisis at the time too. And I just ended a relationship, I remember. And I said, well, you know, I would be kind of a hypocrite to say to these people, oh, what are you going to do? Vote again this year? Are you going to go and vote for more politicians? Haven't you heard the quote about, you know, insanity and doing the same thing over and over again? But it was coming into focus for me that I had kind of not learned from some of my mistakes, or I had failed to apply the lessons learned. I maybe had learned from my mistakes, but I had failed to turn the lessons into meaningful action or preventative action. And I was finding myself in pickles that I had been in before on a personal level. So I started to feel like if I'm just doing this polemic against political people, it was making me feel kind of icky, right? So Wes actually came back, and we did this series called Escape from Imagination Land, where we tried to kind of like work through some of this stuff. And I think it wound up, you know, I kind of fell back into like, oh, aren't these people dumb? But I really, as time went on, I really wanted to, even if it costs, you know, listeners, like even if it cost us the Alex Jones crowd or the Adam Kokesh crowd, I really wanted to turn the show in a more positive and constructive direction.
Yeah.
And we lost listeners because I wasn't as angry. I guess people saw anger or the presentation of anger as passion. And that's what made the show entertaining. But I thought I want the show to be constructive and functional and above all educational, because, you know, what are we trying to do besides provide solutions to the current systems of quote unquote getting educated? So it took a while. Like originally the show was therapy, but then after I got, I don't know, 100 episodes out, I didn't need that outlet as much anymore. And we had a fan base and it had become, it wasn't, you know, wasn't generating any income or anything, but it was like, you know, 2010. And I said, well, okay, well, this has some momentum. What can it be? And I never conceived it being what it is today when I started it.
Yeah. That's so interesting, man. Like that, I think similar for me, like originally it was therapy and now it's like, okay, now I have a responsibility and it's like, okay, so what do I do next? And that makes perfect sense, man. And I agree. Like, I think like, your positive route is definitely, I think it's influenced me, with your conversation with, Ben Stone. Ben was talking about how, I think he said something like, there's enough people out there saying how messed up things are. Like, maybe you should focus on saying something positive or something that you could do. And then, like, because I remember I was sitting on an airplane listening to that conversation, and I was like, man, he's so right, man. I'm really fast to just point out bad shit that's going on because there's so much of it. But why don't I just start focusing on, like, positive things or positive aspects of things? So,
don't you feel like it's so easy to be negative?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's... like, I still will read like Zero Hedge and I'll get on there and I'm like, oh, that everything's fabricated. That's cool. Ebola's coming. Nobody's really cleaning it. They're wearing hazmat suits and rolling up their sleeves and all that stuff.
But then why do you, go ahead. Go ahead. I have a question, but go ahead.
But then, I think at the same time though, but that's a good question. Cause I think I know what you're going to ask. That's kind of like, man, am I just playing a game with myself here? I mean, I think sometimes I want to know what's going on. And sometimes I think it's motivating to see things that are kind of like bad things that are happening. But I feel like there really is this kind of like progressive push. Like you have to have kind of like an opposing force to push it maybe. I don't know. Like I was thinking about that. My friend Kevin, he's actually in San Diego. I met him at the Jackalope Freedom Festival. He's got this website called Radical Optimism. And I was just listening to him and them talking about it. Like things really are getting better, like in reality, even though like everything is kind of like, I feel like the curtain is being lifted and we're kind of seeing that Oz is just a man. But at the same time, it's like things really are getting better. And I think like, I kind of just remembered just to focus on like, okay, I can control stuff for me. Like I can control my life. And I think like, if I control my life, maybe I can inspire other people to control their own lives. And if you kind of like kind of build and build and build, like enough people taking responsibility for themselves kind of like adds up, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've tried to preach the same thing. I was going to ask you why you think people, why we even maybe sometimes gravitate to the negativity. I don't know. I mean, I've gone through a lot of different phases with that and I've tried to explore so for example, like I like to be entertained while I eat, right? If I'm eating by myself. So I'll make my food and I'll come to the computer and I'll open YouTube and I've got, you know, my front page there just displays whatever's new from all the channels I subscribe to. So like I'll check the comedy shows that I like, you know, Red Bar Radio or there's this, channel Joy Camp that have you ever seen Joy Camp?
No.
Check out Joy Camp. They're these guys, I think they're in California and they, you know, they're very like on board with, you know, they do a lot of conspiracy stuff, but they try, it's funny, you know, they're like little shorts. So if they don't have anything new, I usually find myself going through Alex Jones videos. And I say, it just hit me one day, like, oh, this is entertainment.
Yeah.
For me. And that's like, it's something like I didn't want to admit to myself. I've gone through all kinds of different phases with Alex Jones. Alex Jones, like, oh, what an eye-opening. Like going back to when I first heard him in maybe like 2005, oh, this is so eye-opening. I've never heard anyone with this kind of courage to talk like this. All the way up to where I was like sometime in 2012 where like, I think he might be like some kind of an agent after the Piers Morgan debacle, to then just kind of developing a cautious appreciation that, you know, maybe he's just a guy trying to do the best he can with some challenges. But when I found myself just one day at his channel, and I'm like, oh, well, whatever I'm going to watch is going to be doom and gloom. It's not going to be constructive. It's not going to have solutions. There'll be an ad for something that I can buy and maybe, you know, make some part of my life better if I'm concerned about, you know, the heavy metals that are in, or whatever. Anyway, but I'm like, oh, okay, so I'm just here because this is like horror or like doom porn, you know? I mean, that's so.
That's a good term. It's, you know, it's funny too, is like you do kind of look at it like, I don't know, man, like, to get kind of personal, like, you know, the whole procrastination thing that goes on sometimes, you know, why am I looking at porn right now? Am I just trying to kill time? Am I going to rub one out to kill time? It kind of is the same thing in a weird way. And like, and something you said too about, you know, for entertainment, like, you know, when I was talking to Gino Denning after the show.
Yeah.
And I was asking him, and I was like, yeah, man, I've been reading Zero Hedge. It's pretty interesting, man. They always have a bunch of shit that, you know, comes out. He's like, yeah. He kind of said to me, like, you know, you do it to entertain yourself, but in reality, it does kind of like, it kind of stunts what you're really trying to do.
I think that's a possibility. And it was a real challenge for me for a while, like, especially sitting in front of the computer and doing audio work, right? So you're editing, right?
Yeah.
And you're just watching a fucking waveform go by, you know? And it's like, okay, well, so I mean, there's new porn on the internet, I'm sure. I could check that out. I could go to Facebook. I figured there's no way I could just sit here and watch a waveform go by, you know, and every a minute I have to take out an or an ah or something. And other than that, I'm just sitting here watching all these blue lines. So Free Cell seemed to be harmless enough. Like I could play Free Cell. I got into this game Plants versus Zombies a while, where you basically are just planting plants that shoot out like rocks to kill zombies that are trying to invade your backyard. That seemed to work out for a while. But yeah, it's like, it's the same thing with like gravitating back to the doom porn. Those old habits die hard, you know? Yeah. Like you can, if you're not being vigilant, you can sink back into like, oh, well, you know, Facebook would probably be very entertaining right now. But like I learned that if I'm working, that needs to be closed. Like I don't even stand a chance because it's multitasking, you know? Yeah. It becomes multitasking and I'm losing control, or I'm losing like, you know, the optimal attention to the activity that needs it. So what I actually started doing, this is a strange thing, but it helped a little bit. I got one of those balls, those Swiss balls that people do sit-ups on.
Yeah.
And I'd just, when I get restless, I just bounce on it. Like, so it's I'm sitting in on the ball instead of a desk chair. Right? Because you get into the desk chair, you pull it in, you lean back, you know, you're in that kind of cruise control computer mode. So I get up, I have a headphone cord long enough where I can like kind of pace back and forth. I bounce on my red ball. But yeah, it's like sometimes it's just like open an incognito window, you know, and go to set up some tabs. set up some tabs for later, you know? That's productive. And you can, look at
really
pictures.
Because I've done that too.
You can look at pictures and listen to yourself talk at the same time.
That's kind
you
of
can't
a weird thing.
Act on
That's
those
kind
pictures.
Of a weird thing, though. I mean, it's still a weird thing if you think about, like, I'm really getting off to myself and looking at these chicks right now. Like, that's still, like, I thought about that a lot, man. That's such a, that's so funny, man. I've totally...
That's an unwritten podcasting rule. You have to pause the sound of yourself talking when you have a bunch of Google incognito tabs open. Yeah.
That's hilarious. No, I absolutely been there. And that's the thing, too, about multitasking. Like, every study pretty much shows that nobody's good at it. Like, everybody thinks they're good at it, but nobody's really good at it. When I was applying for jobs, when I was kind of in between positions before I have the position I have now, everyone's like, how would you rate your multitasking? And I'd be like, well, I would say it sucks because everybody sucks. If you look at the studies, there's a lot of evidence that shows that. If you want, I can provide some for you. And I don't know if I lost jobs because of that, but I like, it's just like, it's a really weird thing that people actually think that that's something that you can be good at, or that, and it's always better to just focus on one thing and get better at focusing on it. Like, it just learning, tuning in your ability to focus is such a good thing to do. But
yeah.
But the funny thing about stability balls too, is like, I know like a lot of, there's been studies too, that if you are kind of doing like they have, like, there's some companies that actually have like workstations on treadmills, so you can actually work and exercise.
Mark Edge has one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's good, but, I don't know. I think the stability ball is a good idea. You know, keep your core development going too. You know?
Yeah, I haven't tried to actually go and start doing sit-ups, because now I'm counting and trying to listen to myself, and I'm going to miss ums and ahs that way. You know, it's not Pornhub, but it's still counting. It's an extra thing to do. So one good hack for that I've identified, and I think Jake DeSillis was the first person who told me about this, was the Pomodoro method. I don't think there's a real science to this. I think it's just more of a suggestion, and it's really dealing with work intervals. So can you work for 25 minutes and take a 5-minute break, right? But we're all doing all different types of work, right? So maybe 25 minutes is meaningless or pointless to some people. So is it, you know, 50 work, 10 break? I experimented with one the last couple of weeks, 90 minutes work, 20-minute break. Right? Where the work in that 90 minutes is just one thing, because I'm doing a lot of like non-podcast types of work lately. So normally my impulse would be to like try to edit a podcast, and then, okay, well, the podcast is playing and I'm listening to that, because I'll listen to a show like 2 times through and before I put it out. Then I'll try to do all these other things while that's going on. And that's like, nothing is getting done. Everything is getting done okay, but nothing is getting done as well as it should be. So working in intervals, and in that interval, whether it's 25 minutes for some types of work, it's just, I think it differs, you know, for the person. What's your attention span? How long can you sit still? I can't sit still that long. But I was able to focus on one thing pretty much without moving for 90 minutes, you know. So different types of work might call for different work intervals, different people with different needs might call for different work intervals, but I think it's something that everybody should try, you know, and maybe try small intervals first and then work up to longer periods of time. Of course, depending on what kind of work you're doing and how much time on task is fruitful.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. To get back to the podcast, and like, so you've been able to monetize your podcast, which to a podcaster like myself, I haven't really attempted, but most people can't really make, like, I found that podcasting is great for like social currency. Really good to get to know people and networking. But I think like to actually get like money that I can pay bills with, like just to get money, like, you've been able to kind of do that. And what strategies did you have to kind of, to be able to monetize? You said you do get contributions. What other kind of approaches did you take to make that successful?
Well, I would say that there's a few things at play here. I mentioned this, I think, in our live show that we did last week, this Monday, that the more successful a podcast becomes, the more it costs, right?
Yeah.
Because the better it has to be, and also the more successful a podcast becomes, the more time it requires. So when 150 people listen to the show, I didn't mind volunteering 8 hours a week to work on it for free. You know, it was a hobby.
Yeah.
But then when thousands of people listened and there were basically content requirements and the show needed to grow and I needed to respond to emails and I needed to, you know, track numbers and put, you know, new types of content or try to take things to the next level, like suddenly it was 30 hours a week. And I really have a hard time, for how much money I make doing it, I have a hard time working more than 30, 35 hours a week because I really can't justify the hourly wage. Like, yeah. if more people come in and subscribe, like, you know, if we got 150 new subscribers in the next month, I'd be willing to work 50 hours a week. Because then the hourly way, like I've always just done things like kind of as a contract worker, like what is my time worth an hour? So I find myself, you know, getting frustrated when somebody will ask for my time on like an educational issue, just because I don't know if this is like how other people feel about this, but it's kind of frustrating. Like I'm struggling to invest this much time and make money doing this educational thing. So somebody says, hey, could I have more of your time to, you know, ask you to read something or tell me what your opinion is about something? I would just politely say, can you post this in the group where you can get, you know, the eyes of 600 people who are as smart as me to give you opinions or feedback about this, because they can do it voluntarily. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's, I don't feel like it's unreasonable, and I understand why people do it. And obviously, I know what it's like to see, oh, here's somebody who has a fair amount of expertise in this particular area. I'm hungry for knowledge. I like this person's show. I feel like I have a connection with them. I wouldn't have a hard time doing it myself, right? Like,
yeah.
Fortunately, all the people that I, except for Wes, like all the people that I admired came to me, you know?
Pretty awesome.
And that was just because like we were kind of in this closed network of Liberty podcasters, right? But I don't know how comfortable I would have been like going and seeking those people out, but it wasn't because I didn't want to, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I always think about time with like an hourly dollar amount attached to it, you know, and I want to be respectful of that, especially if people are doing the same thing. So I, how the hell did I get off on that tangent?
Hey,
which
I
was
like
more
it,
just
man.
Me venting.
I like it, man. I like it, man. It's, I wanted to know Brett Vignette, man. That's the whole point. That was my scheme to get you to talk to me. I'm like, hey, I just wanted to talk about you and your podcast. That was my scheme. I'm like, he'll bite hard. No, I'm just kidding.
Right, right, right. Okay. So I'm just trying to backtrack to how I got off course there. We're talking about monetizing the show, and I think it kind of had to be like I didn't do this on purpose, right? I didn't. This wasn't conscious. It just kind of happened. I kind of like went beyond this point and then a door like locked behind me. And here's an example of what I mean. Maybe I shouldn't have used my real name to do the show.
I think that all the time.
Right. When then I go out and occasionally try to re-enter the mainstream education field. You know, I'll just like once in a while when I get kind of worried about money, maybe I'll throw a couple resumes out for, you know, tutoring jobs or something. And, you know, I don't hear back and I know that I'm more than qualified and I'm usually underbidding, you know, what the typical rates are. So are people Googling? I mean, I would be, if you're going to let somebody work with your kids, you'd be insane not to Google them. And maybe it was just this enthusiasm that I had, this excitement in the beginning that I didn't think of, that didn't occur to me. I'm like, I'm Brett Vignette and this is what I have to say. That's who I really am. You know, that's my real name. And I think as that name has become more connected to the phrase school sucks on the internet, I've kind of like gone down this path past the point of no return. Like, this is what I do now. There probably is no going back. So
was probably subconsciously something that you probably wanted for yourself in a weird way. Like, because I remember when I was starting my podcast, and mine's not, I mean, it's nowhere near School Sucks level of popularity, but like the same thing, like I was like, well, I'm going to use my real name. And then I'm like, oh, let me talk about episode one. Yeah, I don't have a job. I did a bunch of mushrooms and then I started this podcast and I'm like, man, I'm just like, so like now I'm at work and I'm in the closet about being a podcaster. Cause I'm like, I don't want people to know, like, I don't need these people to know that this is what I do for fun. So instead I just go to work, I get paid, I go home and I live my life.
I remember, I applied for this, this position with this company called Catalyst that I mentioned earlier, and they work in Connecticut. They work all over the country, but I was working for them in Connecticut, and they do this thing called the SAT boot camp. And they showed me what the compensation would be for about after training a 10-hour time investment to teach this class, and I thought it looked pretty good. So they're like, okay, here's just the, you know, requirements that we need to hire you. And one of the requirements was going to a police station to get fingerprinted. Right. So I remember like being in the police department and my heart was just beating so fast, you know, like I'm in a police department. I'm going into a locked portion of the station where I don't have the keys. Right. Yeah. Now, what if they put my fingerprints in and I'm like on some kind of a list? Right. What if the IRS wants me? What if there's a federal warrant for my arrest? Like all these things just start going through my mind when I'm sitting there locked in the police station, giving up my fingerprints so I can get a job, you know? So yeah, I mean, there were all kinds of things early on where just the enthusiasm of becoming a podcaster and getting the word out there, there were like all these scenarios that didn't play out at that time. But I think it was Napoleon Hill in the book, The Master Key to Riches, which is, you know, it's not like a Bible for a success, but it's a good thing for people to check out, especially if they want to be entrepreneurs. I think in that book, he talks about, you know, all these people who left themselves no other options. Like they say, okay, this is my path and I have to succeed, right? There's no escape hatch. There's no safety net. I kind of feel that way sometimes. And I've talked about like, well, what if this just got shut off? You know, what would I do the next day? I mean, I'm sure that with thought and reflection, I could find the next thing to do, but I don't know what it is right now. I mean, this is really what I want this to do. I want this to grow. And, part of the monetization of the show is about surviving because you kind of get to this place where you can't really work a job anymore and do it, right? Like I couldn't just be like checking emails and like dealing with PayPal problems and, you know, like all those little things that come up and editing a show the way I like to do it, which is going over it once and then going over it again. And, you know, first for, you know, trying to shape it and then once to kind of like fine tune it and get all the junk out of it. It's a lot of time. Like doing video work is a ton of time. Now, maybe some people have this talent where they can just like, you know, be like Steph does. And obviously he's like cultivated it over a period of many years where he just gets in front of a camera and talks and it's great, you know, but that's not me. I can't do that. I can't do that yet. Maybe someday I'll be able to, but to produce something that's comparable to work that he does, if I can do that, you know, 2 hours of his are like 10 hours of mine, you know? So, but that's what I want to do. And hopefully maybe one day it's like, you know, 8 hours for the same thing and 6 hours for the same thing and 4 hours for the same thing. Then, I'd be making a lot of money, you know, every hour. But I've said to people like, this is a product. This is a program. This is a message for people who probably don't have a lot of money to throw around. So if you're an adult and you're listening to this show, I hope you'll support it. You know, I hope that if you are really thinking that there are viable educational alternatives, you know, to public school, to higher education, you'll consider this to be one, or at least a message, even if this is not like a whole curriculum that takes the place of whatever somebody else would do, it's at least something that more people should hear. And even if I'm not the best messenger, you know, like I have this experience, I think I'm pretty good at it. and you know, just pick out a couple of your favorite shows and send it to somebody young, you know, or somebody, you know, somebody, and they're interested in this, this, and this, or they've had this, this, and this problem. You know, we've covered a lot of bases. So I think there's something there for everybody. And I love to hear the stories of how people came to the show and started listening. That really, like, that means a lot to me. And like I said, a while ago.
Yeah. Well, I would just say, like, people just reaching out, like, for me personally, like, I'm thrilled to death when somebody wants to interact with me. Like, I'm just as excited to talk to them personally.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the same way. Sorry I interrupted you.
I am too. And I want to kind of amend something that I said before. The kinds of people who have bothered me are few and far between. Anybody can ask me to read three paragraphs, right? And most people ask me to read even less. I felt like there was a couple people. I don't know why. I hope I didn't make it sound like that was everybody. There were a couple people who said, "Hey, Brett, you know a lot about education. Should I take? Where can I take the SAT in the United States?" That was one. I'm thinking about going to college. What are the, and like asking for lists, those kinds of things. And that has happened, but most people are very polite, very considerate. I try to get back to everybody. That Facebook group that I set up has been awesome, because what I've always wanted is more listener interaction. I wanted to be able to, like, if something happened to me, all of this could just go on,
yeah.
You know? Like, it's not the Brett show. You know, somebody could take my place. So there's other people who've had the same types of experiences. There's somebody who could fill my shoes. And this is just this environment, this online environment, this online community that we've created that has this message that, you know, if it wasn't one peer person, like three people could pick up the reins and keep the show going. Even though I had a story, and even though, like, I think I'm good at doing the show, I never wanted the show to be, like, really about me or that I was the central figure. I think sometimes people want that. Like, the more I learn about marketing, the more I'm kind of like, oh, gosh, do I have to do this, this, and this to really be successful? Can't I just totally be myself and do what I feel like is right and respectful? But that's not how marketing works, unfortunately.
Well, I think so, it's, but at the same time, man, it's important to do things in your own terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And
because
that's been,
if as soon as you fat sacrifice that, you're going to lose more.
Right.
And I think as well, back to doing things on your own terms, I think, you know, something I think that as a podcaster, that, you know, is like, you know, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People has really stuck out as, you know, seek to understand, not to be understood. And I think, like, that's always, like, man, like, when you have a guest on, it's always about your guest. It's always about them, and you do your best to assist. And I think that's what makes your show so great. And I try to do that on my show, but, like, I don't think, like, learning the trivium, like, getting started to learn, like, the start studying the trivium method, like, when you had Gene on, like, I, like, that was, like, it was a perfect show. And something Gene said was, that was such a good show because Brett had studied so much, and I honestly, he was helping me out so much, and it made me sound way, way better than what I probably would have.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And no, you were absolutely great. I feel like, I didn't learn enough about you. So we'll have to do this again. I'm still working on, like, getting interviewed, that whole getting interviewed thing.
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing is, like, you're like, whoa, okay, yeah, I'm used to interviewing somebody else. Okay, yeah. I get to be interesting now. But I think that's, like, it's kind of like it's just kind of like how, you know, your friends helped you out by coming on your show and stuff like that. It's the same thing. I mean, like, you know, I can get the host of the School Sucks podcast on my show. So it's like I can piggyback off of Brett. And yeah. I think that's just kind of how it works. It's like, it's paying it forward in a sense. And I think, but I appreciate that. I appreciate the compliments. I mean, it's, you know, listening to good podcasters is helping. Also, just, you know, I don't, it's just kind of like what you said. I don't want this to be about me, like the sample hour. It's not the Drew sample hour. It's the sample hour. Like, and the whole point was to play off my last name and say, well, you can get a sample of a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, I appreciate you coming on, and I'd love to have you on again. It was fun talking to you. And what was funny was at the beginning of the show, we started talking about other stuff and we were getting into conversations about stuff. And I'm like, well, let's talk about you, Brett. Let's get back to Brett.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another amendment. We did just start a sort of supplemental podcast series that has the tremendously pretentious and self-congratulatory title of Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass. it's me and Osborne and Gardner Goldsmith from Liberty Conspiracy. So that should be coming out right around the time that I put this show out. But yeah, other than that, I actually have to say I felt pretty damn important for the last 85 minutes, and well, that's very nice.
You should. You are important, man. That's the whole thing. Like, you have listeners that it makes their, like, oh man, it's a new school sucks. Let me tune into this.
I know. That's always like an exciting thing to think about, because I think about that with like, there aren't too many podcasts that I feel that way anymore. Maybe there's a couple. There are things that most people who listen to my show probably don't listen to. But when a new one comes out, I'm like, oh great. I've been waiting for this. I can't wait for it to download and listen to it.
So, real quick, when you became a podcaster, did you kind of switch up what you listened to because you didn't want to? Did you ever feel like, man, I don't want to sound too much like this person, and they've heavily influenced me, so I need to really put like an arm's length away so I can have my own voice in a sense, or have my own show in a sense?
Yes, that's great. That's a great question. Stefan Molyneux was probably the hardest, right? Because when I first interacted with him, I had heard his show, just kind of gone through and selected things that I liked. But after the conversation that I had with him, we got a lot of his listeners. This was 2009. And I started just consuming his show, like three, four. I mean, he had, you know, I don't know, 1,000 something shows then. So three, four shows a day. And his way of speaking was so, I mean, I guess some people hate it, but I loved it. I thought, like, I just couldn't get enough of listening to this guy talk. And, you know, just the pace and the intonation and his vocabulary and his humor, you know. I mean, I've heard funnier people. I've heard people with less corny jokes, but he's pretty much like the whole package as far as like communication is concerned. Like, he's fantastic. So, I was like, really, like, I was listening back to myself. I'm like, I'm starting to sound like this guy, you know, like little things that I was saying, little emphasis, like words that I was using that I thought like were coming out of my head, but were put into my head by listening to his show. You know, so you start like, you know, like you listen to a podcast, right? And one of the ideas from the podcast like goes into your brain and kind of rattles around in the back for a while and then gets kicked out, you know, of your mouth. And you're like, oh, I'm pretty clever. That happened to me. That happened to me a few times. Another one was a comedy show that I listened to called Red Bar Radio, which I don't recommend for most people. I think most people would find it horrifying. But the host is from Chicago and has a kind of an interesting way of speaking. And I find that I pick up some of his technique. Well, I don't know if he's really doing it as a technique, but some of his little tics come through when I'm talking sometimes, if I've been listening too much. So yeah, that's a great question. I don't listen to Steph that much anymore. I mean, I still think I don't agree with everything that he's doing, but I still think he does great work. I still think that he is an authority on a lot of really important issues. I feel like part of it, and I think I said this to his guys when I was hosting his call-in show, sometimes as a podcast, it's frustrating to listen to somebody who's so good, you know, who's also like kind of doing the same thing that you're doing, but they're just like amazing at it, you know, when you not wanting to compare yourself. So I check in with him once in a while, but I don't listen as much as I used to. And I also really don't have time to listen as much as I used to, because I'm always, you know, I mean, most of my work is listening to myself talk or listening back to myself talk. So I don't really have much time for as many people as I would like anymore to listen to them talk because, you know, I have a life outside of this as well.
Wait,
I have a girlfriend.
Wait, you have a life? Get out of town.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's fantastic. I have a wonderful girlfriend and we spend a lot of time together and we really enjoy each other. And that's kind of like, I would find that when I was single, I would just like work all the time, right? Like I would just always like my life was kind of at the computer. So I'd be like, okay, well, what work things can I do? But then when we got together, I was like, okay, well, she works these days and has these days off. So now I'm going to make a work schedule around her work schedule, right? So like these will be the times that I work. And then when she's not at work, I'll spend time with her. So suddenly, like it, when it was night, I wasn't working anymore, you know? And a life developed outside of doing this stuff. So that was nice. And like her schedule, and the reason why I say I made my schedule around her, like her schedule wasn't flexible, mine was. So that's why I did that.
That's awesome, man. Well, tell you what, we shot for an hour and we hit an hour and a half. So
great. But let's do it again.
Yeah, definitely. Let's have you on again. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. Please go to iTunes and rate and subscribe. So review and subscribe. So iTunes is very much heavily so based on what reviews you give us podcasters, not downloads. They don't actually host anything. They just mirror it. So please tell on iTunes that our podcasts are great, specifically Brett's, so he can attract more subscribers.
Also, thank you.
Yeah, not a problem. Also, go to Facebook, join the School Sucks podcast group. Is that you can just join it, right? Or is it an invite only?
You can request it and I'll approve you.
Request it, yeah. Request it and maybe you'll get approved. So do something nice for Brett.
There's only two people. There's only two people I will not let back in. One was like an Israeli national who was talking about killing Muslims. But at the same time, he like seemed to really get that like the whole school was a problem. But we just couldn't overlook the fact that he wanted to kill Muslims. And my webmaster at the time was actually from Israel. And he's like, this is not good. We you know, we can't have this guy. So he got banned and another guy got banned because he just wouldn't leave me alone. So there's two. If you're not those two people, you're in.
Please, please. Also, if you can't afford it, contribute to Brett's podcast. It's a great podcast. He does a great job. So please, 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 please compensate him for his time and efforts. Go to you have schoolsucks.com?
Yeah, schoolsucksproject.com.
Schoolsucksproject.com. Visit his site, go to his YouTube page. He has some awesome videos. He just released some about on John Taylor Gatto. They're all on Prussian education.
There's a whole playlist that has 13 videos and they're all just clips that I like. First of all, they things that translate to video, but also things when they're all put together will tell hopefully a somewhat consistent story and give people a better understanding of the history of government schooling in the United States, where it came from, where people want it to go, and various transformations that it's gone through. So it's a massive book, and I'm probably, when all is said and done, going to pull 30 excerpts out of it and that are going to turn into videos. I've done 13 so far.
That's awesome. So rate and subscribe and review and favorite on YouTube. And thank you very much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it.
Hey, can you do one thing before we go?
Yes.
Can you plug all of your stuff for my audience? Because I'll repost this.
Oh, thank you, sir. Yes. So please follow me on Twitter. I'm at Drew Sample. Also follow at The Sample Hour on Twitter. Please go to my Facebook page. Go to www.facebook.com/The Sample Hour and like my Facebook page. Please, just like I said for Brett's, please rate, review, and subscribe. I would really appreciate it. If you think I'm a cool guy, interact with me. I'll talk to you. It'll be fun. Also, I am a member of the Inspired Disorder Collective. Go to the inspireddisordercollective.com. Check out the other great shows on there. My friend Ray Taylor on Twitter does a great job of helping all of us. Check out Ray's art and support Ray's art. And also that also supports me if you use my coupon code on the Inspired Disorder Collective. And that's pretty much it. Oh, one thing too, because we might as well. If you are in the Columbus, Ohio area, we're going to go to, there's a Death Squad show. Red Band's coming in town. So go to that. We're going to have a big event for Death Squad, Ohio. And that's it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun, and I will totally do it again anytime.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you, Brett. Thanks for listening.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. He just say a person's name and then tell a fact about where they live.
What a nice place to visit if you want to check out the headquarters of some places that make delicious food.
The real hip hop, MCing, and DJing from your own mind, you know.
I guess right now we should start the show.
Let's start today with James H. from Plymouth in the United Kingdom. What a storied place Plymouth is. Of course, this one is a no-brainer. In 1620, the Pilgrims set sail for the New World from Plymouth. And when they landed, they established a new colony and named it Plymouth, the second English colony in the United States. But the British weren't exactly two for two when it comes to setting up new colonies, if you know what I mean, at this point. And that brings us to another Plymouth resident, also a seafarer of questionable common sense, named Sir Francis Drake. Now, many of you remember this story that I've told. I usually call it one of the wild cards of history. In 1588, the Spanish Armada had decided to invade England, but a storm came and scattered their fleet. And then the British went out with their little clipper ships and picked off the Armada, sunk a bunch of their ships, and forced the rest to retreat. And that was a very, very significant turning point in the exploration and colonization of the New World. Most of the New World at that time, what was called the New World, was under Spanish control until that event. But before Sir Francis Drake would go out and take on the Armada, the invading Spanish Armada in 1588, he insisted on completing a game of bowls. Now, what is bowls? Bowls, or lawn bowls, is a sport where you try to roll balls so they stop close to a smaller ball called a jack or a kitty. It's often played on an uneven surface to add a little bit of a challenge. Now, it is said that Drake enjoyed bowls so much because it was the 16th century and he was British. Up next, we have Aaron C., who is in Ladson, South Carolina. Ladson is actually right to the west of a town in South Carolina we've talked about on the show before, Goose Creek, where they had that famous high school drug raid with all the dogs and the cops 10 years ago. And hey, there might not be much to do in Ladson. It's just a little suburb of Charleston. But if you're ever in the area and you've got some time to kill, why don't you head over to Village Square for day bingo? Why should we resign ourselves to playing bingo only at night? You know, am I right? Aaron, I'm really sorry if there's a lot more going on there and I just didn't do enough research. I hear Charleston is really nice. Moving on to Dave B., who is in Elmhurst, Illinois. Well, what a nice place to visit if you want to check out the headquarters of some places that make delicious food. What a nice place if you're into sweet, delicious treats. Keebler had their headquarters there until 2001. City is also home to the headquarters for Sunshine Biscuits. And get this, now you're listening to this and you're saying, oh, I can't take anymore. Well, guess what? Famous Amos Cookies also come from Elmhurst. So, you know, yum. And it's home of the YouTube sensation Keenan Cahill, who I am understanding is famous for lip syncing, whose YouTube channel has almost 700,000 subscribers, which means the end is probably near. The end of Western civilization, I mean. Continuing on to Larry G., who is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I love any town with the word rapids in the name, but you gotta watch out for floods, and they had a big one there in 2008, where the Cedar River reached a record high of 31 feet. 50% higher than the previous record high. Over 1,000 city blocks were flooded, more than 10 square miles. Elijah Wood and Ashton Kutcher both call Cedar Rapids home, but fortunately neither one of them were there when the flood happened. Just ordinary people were there. And finally today, we have Jared H., who lives in Rose Hill, Kansas. That's in Butler County. Did you know Butler County was a dry county until the Kansas Constitution was amended in 1986? It means you couldn't buy alcohol there. The little city of Rose Hill was named by J.H. Lowry. He was from Rose Hill, New York. And it's actually been in four different locations. That's a nice story, Brett. What do I do if I get stuck there? Well, here's my suggestion. I would head over to see Phil Brinkley, who welds scrap metal into dinosaurs, bugs, pigs, and dragons. Check him out at Jurassic Art, 256 West Rosewood Street in Rose Hill, Kansas. Phil will be glad you came, and he has pulled out all the stops, I assure you. He even has dinosaurs riding motorcycles and a Volkswagen bug made into a bug.
New subscriber, geography, trivia.